It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
You're listening to the Manchester United Weekly Podcast. Your hosts are Harry Robinson and Jack Tate. We talk about the latest going-ons at United, look ahead to our next game, and give you an update on the youth sides, the club's loanees, and Casey Stoney's women's team. Enjoy the show.
Wonderful finish!
Fabulous free kick.
He's done it again!
Welcome back, welcome back, welcome back. It's June and we're about to watch Manchester United play in the Premier League. It's been a long time since we've sat on opposite sides of the Atlantic, me and Jack talking about football, and a lot has happened. Thousands, hundreds of thousands more have sadly lost their lives because of the coronavirus, and the murder of George Floyd has created an environment in which we are obliged to think, reflect and learn, and sometimes protest. So today we will be talking about the extension of Odin Ighalo's loan move, the players we think will do best out of the blocks for Manchester United, and how we fit Bruno Fernandes and Paul Pogba into the same midfield. And we'll give you a quick update on what's happened with Casey Stoney's United women's side and their season. But first, Jack, we, I think, as members of a society in which, in both the United Kingdom and the USA, we are the beneficiaries of greater freedoms and opportunity than our black counterparts, our Asian counterparts, and many other minorities who don't share that same freedom and opportunity. It's been a pretty crazy few weeks, and I think it's a weird one to have to talk about and have to plan, because this is something that we don't normally talk about, because it doesn't normally affect our lives. And I think for us it's quite easy to talk about it when it's in the news and then forget about it for the rest of the time. I think this is kind of a seminal moment where, in the future, hopefully, I mean, we'll see if this happens, and we're going to have to try and keep this, but where people will talk about this all the time rather than only when it's the headline news.
Yeah, it's been, well, I mean, one of the craziest few weeks I think that any of us will ever live through, and it, you're right, it really does feel like a seminal moment in our history. I think it's often difficult when you're living through a certain period to understand how important it is and how sort of historical this will end up being in sort of 10, 15 years' time. And I mean, the last few months in general with obviously COVID and, you know, unprecedented pandemic, but now with what really is not just sort of Black Lives Matter protests, which we've seen before, but this movement that has kind of swept across such a broader kind of audience and broader spectrum. I think almost every single person has been affected by this and has been at least kind of engaging with it in some capacity. And I think this is probably one of the first times in my lifetime I can remember thinking, knowing in the moment, that we're living through a truly historic time. And it feels especially important and especially like a seminal moment, because, you know, the world we live in is fragile right now, with COVID having destroyed our kind of way of life. You know, so much about our daily routine, our daily lives have been changed, even down to less important things like us being able to do this podcast every week and having Manchester United games to review. And I think the combination of having that sort of fragile world combined with now this sort of unprecedented wave of protests, it really is a huge moment in our lives. And I think it requires all of us, even if we are you know, doing a podcast about something seemingly unrelated, it requires all of us to engage with this and make sure that we are taking the time to, you know, put our thoughts and our energy into thinking how we might have contributed to this in the past and how we can stop contributing to this in the future.
Yeah. And I think, look, this is a football podcast and well, more than anything, it's a Manchester United podcast. And the reason we started this, however, 4 years ago, more than 4 years ago now, is because we wanted to chat about Manchester United every week and do so in some kind of set format rather than just over a pint or a cup of tea. But this is something that we, I think we have to talk about, because even in starting this podcast, it reflects the privilege that we've had. Because the reason I could start this podcast was because I got a good education. I come from a family where I know journalists, and I have figures in my life that I can look up to and say, I want to be a journalist. I want to talk about football for a living. And that's partly why I started this podcast. But also I thought I had the structure where I could start a podcast. I had the financial means to do it. I had a laptop good enough to do it. I could buy a podcast microphone, whatever. These are small things and are besides the bigger point. But I think even in starting this podcast, it reflects that privilege. And in football, there has been an enormous amount of progress made. I think that the biggest progress has probably been in the last 10 years. And yet there really is systemic racism remaining in football, not just from the stands, because ultimately what happens in the stands is a reflection of society. And that's an opinion I've long held. But within how we speak about black players, within how few black defensive midfielders are there, how few black goalkeepers there are at the top level. It's not that black people, black men, black women can't dive and catch a ball in the goal. It's that often, and this is something that Andre Onana, the Ajax keeper, Cameroonian goalkeeper, has spoken about, that black men and women aren't trusted to, that they're not deemed safe enough, trustworthy enough to keep a goal in a football match. They're seen as fast, quick, powerful, strong and athletic, but they're not seen as reliable, trustworthy, creative.
Well, yeah, I don't know about you, Harry, but I remember growing up in a big city, you'd often come up playing like Sunday league football against teams that were from predominantly black areas, and every single member in the team would be black except the goalkeeper. And I can't count the number of teams that I used to play that are like that. And it's so true. I think it often comes down to this idea that, you know, black players are suited to the positions that don't require so much sort of technical ability. It's, as you said there, it's all about the pace and the power. It's why so many black players get shunted to fullback, where, you know, the stereotype is they can just run up and down the wing and barge people off the ball, or they can be wingers so they can run fast. I remember even my school team, just, you know, when we all kind of first started playing football together, is the black players would always be trialed as wingers or forwards because that was where they were seen as most useful, you know, whereas the central midfielders would always be the white players who were, and it was like supposed to have, I guess, better like technical ability. And it just, you know, racism in football has obviously never been far from the public consciousness, with sort of genuine kind of like individual level racism that we've seen in the stands and kind of horrible abuse that's been hurled at players from fans. But I think this sort of underlying systemic racism, it's something different. I think it's been one of the hardest things about this, is trying to explain to people who maybe aren't very well versed in racism, but are trying to learn more about the difference between sort of hate crimes, like we see when, you know, black players are called monkeys and all this stuff, and just despicable abuse, versus systemic racism, and that we can still have racism going on even if, you know, men in the stands aren't hurling abuse at players. And this is 100% part of that. You know, the pipeline for black players is inherently more difficult than white players. And in football, you know, I think Romelu Lukaku is a great example of this.
Yeah.
I mean, and even Danny Welbeck as well. I remember when Danny Welbeck first broke into the United team too. You know, he scored an absolute worldie on his debut at Stoke with like 30 yards into the top corner. But all anyone wanted to talk about after the game was the pace and power that he showed. It wasn't about the technique on his goal. It wasn't about the technique that he had in all of his passing. It was the pace and power. And it was the same thing with Lukaku as well. you know, that his technique was terrible, and he was just all, he was just a big bully, just pace and power, and it's so pervasive across all of football.
Yeah, and this interview I read with Andre Onana recently, he said he hadn't been signed. This is a separate issue. This is more about the obvious hate crime that you're talking, the kind of the active racism rather than the systemic passive racism. And Onana said he'd been on the verge of signing for an elite club in Serie A, the Italian league, and they'd said to his agent, one of the directors of the club, that he was we believe that Onana is a great goalkeeper, but unfortunately we cannot sign him. A black goalkeeper would bring us a lot of problems in front of our fans. Now, this is in Italy, but a country that is far worse than the United Kingdom, and there's no argument with that. But in England and the rest of the UK, there have been so many examples of this, and I think we are now in a place where we see these active acts of racism, and they are widely condemned. They are generally sorted out within football, and there's no debate about them anymore. There's no one generally, and I say it's because there is some things, but they're not being covered up. They're not being swept under the carpet. There's people speaking out. Raheem Sterling speaks out, Marcus Rashford. So many players do. But there's no need to do that. But these problems remain. And in terms of recent examples, and this, I was looking at this because I thought, well, I think it's worth reminding ourselves of what's gone on recently, and maybe before I wouldn't have linked all these things together, and I wouldn't have remembered them and drawn them all together. But on February the 10th of this year, a 12-year-old boy charged in connection with racist chants against Alfredo Morelos, who plays for Rangers, Colombian international in Scotland. On January the 31st. The Home Office released figures that showed racial incidents in English football has risen by more than 50%. In late January, Athletic Bilbao player Naki Williams was subjected to monkey chants by a section of the home crowd against Espanyol. In the Netherlands in November, first and second division players refused to play in the first minute of matches after another player had been racially abused from Excelsior. At the Manchester Derby in the start of December, December the 7th, Fred was racially abused as a City supporter made monkey noises and gestures. In February, a West Ham fan shouted Islamophobic abuse at Mohamed Salah. Chelsea fans described him as a bomber. An Arsenal fan racially abused Kalidou Koulibaly for Napoli. A Burnley supporter charged with a racially aggravated offence against Brighton's Gaetan Bong. Millwall charged by the Football Association. These are a selection of a few from the last 12 months. And yes, there's been massive progress made, but that's why we have to talk about this.
One thing that's a very common misconception with all of this is that, you know, I remember having a conversation with someone a few weeks ago saying, well, you know, not many people are racist anymore, so it doesn't matter. And it's not the point. You know, there are still so many examples of this happening, and even one is too many to have, you know. And as much as we condemn it, and we talk it down, we say how bad it is, where is the action behind it, you know? How long has kick it out been a thing in football? I can remember going to Leyton Orient games as a, you know, 7 or 8 year old, and kick it out was kind of already there. And that's what, 12, 13 years ago now. And yet it's still such a huge problem. And it may just be that we've got better at detecting it, and that racism has become much more, much bigger thing in sort of the public consciousness. And so it's maybe getting more headlines rather than actually becoming more common. But, you know, this is still such a huge problem that we see it every single week. And you're kind of seeing it today in London. We're recording this on Saturday, the 13th of June. There are just a huge anti-Black Lives Matter protests in London clashing with the police. And, you know, without meaning to generalise, it looks like a lot of the same sort of demographics as sort of the type of men who are
England away crowd
hurling a lot of this racist abuse at football games. Exactly.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you just think yes, we have made some progress, but I think the thing that I wouldn't want to see from this is the Premier League and maybe kick it out, or maybe a new organisation take some more drastic action, because putting out all these statements and you know, mandating that Premier League clubs do a certain amount of community service hours and stuff like that.
Yeah,
it's great, and it looks great on a publicity statement, but it's not doing enough. It's not getting to the root of the problem. And I think the one thing that I hope comes out of this moment, because there is so much attention on Black Lives Matter, and I think for the first time ever, so many white people are starting to kind of reckon a lot more with their role in sort of creating a racist society. I hope that the Premier League and Kick It Out and the FA take more action to create a better, more detailed plan, because we haven't made enough progress in the last 15 years.
And when the Premier League returns, and we will get on to talking about the return of the Premier League soon, but when the Premier League returns, the 20 club captains have agreed that Black Lives Matter will be on the back of players' shirts instead of player names. Now, this is a gesture, a show. It is nothing more. And the cynic inside of me, and I think many people think this is pointless. But I think it is worth, and you do look at it and think, yeah. But I think it is worth noting how significant that is. It's something that would have seemed utterly implausible even only weeks ago. The Premier League supporting a movement like this, no chance before. And at the moment, I despair that we are distracted by Fawlty Towers, Little Britain, Harry Enfield. It shows how much that Black Lives Matter can be supported by the Premier League. Shows how much the discourse has shifted. The Premier League, as Jonathan Liu wrote in The Guardian on Saturday, it has normally been an institution, and this is a good quote from the piece, so allergically hostile to the discourse of politics, ethics and human rights that it allowed clubs to be purchased by actual nation states. And this is a point that it is nothing more than a gesture, but it is quite significant, the thinking behind it.
Yeah, and the point about, you know, clubs being taken over by actual nation states is, I think, very, very pressing at the moment, considering in the last few years we've had rumours of, you know, United being taken over by Saudi crown princes. We've had, you know, obviously Manchester City owned by, was it Mubarak, I think is his last name, Sheikh Mubarak, who, although not the leader of the United Arab Emirates, certainly has some extremely close ties to the nation as a whole. We've had rumours of the Qatari royal family wanting to buy a Premier League club. It's is, you know, I understand that football is a money game to a large extent, but there comes a point where you have to start reckoning with the ethics of doing this kind of thing. And, you know, especially in the case of Qatar and Saudi Arabia, and to a slightly lesser extent, the United Arab Emirates, these are countries that routinely are oppressing people in some of the most brutal fashion. I mean, I don't have the figure off the top of my head, but hundreds and hundreds of workers, mainly from South Asia, have been killed in making stadiums for Qatar's World Cup that was, you know, got to them through bribes. In Saudi Arabia, you have some of the most oppressive policies against women in the UAE. It's, you know, migrant workers from South and Southeast Asia, you know, put in sort of internment camps for their living quarters. And it's just, and that's really not to say that these are the only countries doing this kind of stuff. The UK is, you know, certainly not a bystander in any of that.
Yeah.
But I think there comes a point where you have to draw a line as the Premier League and as an institution that some things are just unacceptable. And, you know, I think it's a good first step to see Dele Alli has been banned for his previous tweets about coronavirus. I think that is a good precedent for the Premier League to set, that coming out of this, they aren't going to accept, you know, bad tweets, and they aren't just going to say, you can't do this anymore. There needs to be some sort of tangible, real consequences for Premier League players, because they are role models and they need to be held to a standard that other people can follow. And the problem is that, you know, if you tweet something, you get a slap on the wrist and have to apologize and maybe get a few $1,000 fine, which you'll make back in the next 3 hours, that doesn't really do anything to stop you from doing it. It needs action. I think giving out bans to players is the right course of action.
Yeah, and I think this is an easy way to move on to the... I was reading another piece in The Athletic. Adam Crafton interviewed Emil Heskey, and they were talking about the Romelu Lukaku song at United, which was a pretty big debate a couple of years ago. And it's interesting because to the majority of match-going United fans, that was a funny song. And to be honest, when I first heard it, I thought that's pretty funny. But we have to educate ourselves on these things. And with that particular example, Romelu Lukaku asked fans not to sing it. So did the club. And we stopped. And at that point, we were able to educate ourselves. And I think the problem for me was, I think up until now, and I hope this is a point where this changes, there was a big problem that education was kind of forgotten in the process of telling off. And I never got round to singing that song ever, because before the season even began, I think I read the reasons that it was wrong. It encouraged the racial stereotype that black men have big penises, a myth made up and peddled for hundreds of years to discourage white women from dating black men, by a myth peddled by racists. And once you know that, I think most will probably agree, I'm not going to sing that now. I now understand. But back then, the debate was, it's racist, it's not racist, and so on. And few, and some did, but few said, this is why it's wrong, here's what you need to know. And I think this moment, hopefully, is kind of changing that around. But we should wrap up, because we haven't got that much time. We need to talk a little bit about real football. But this was another thing from the Heskey piece. 11 black, this was another thing from the Heskey piece, 11 FA board members, none of them black. The Lawn Tennis Association, 12 board members, none of them black. RFU, 14 board members, none of them black. Swim England, 12 board members, none of them black. Same goes for golf, British cycling and UK sport. And this is a problem. There are no black representatives making the decisions which are trying to change the situation of racism in sport. And until that happens, you're not going to get the correct number, the proportional number of black coaches appointed. You're not going to get the correct fines handed down. You're not going to get the correct education. And I think that's where sport can really focus its attentions on, in terms of what it can do to change the country.
Yeah, Emil Heskey's absolutely right. You know, it needs to have more representation for non-white people on these powerful boards, because it's all well and good, you know, with all the best intentions in the world. You know, if you or I were sat on the Premier League board, you know, we can be saying we all need to educate ourselves, we all need to be doing more, which is great. But it's very hard to know what exactly to do without experiencing this stuff yourself. And, you know, we're sitting here as, you know, two 20-something white boys, and don't get me wrong, it's great that we're having these conversations and that we're taking the time to engage in these issues, but systematic change and sort of foundational level change isn't going to come about with only white voices involved in making the policies and making these decisions moving forward. And we're starting to see a little bit more involvement from non-white people, whether that's in government or on, you know, in businesses or whatever, but sport has such a long way to go, because there are, you know, there are so many very, very engaged non-white athletes that are just fundamentally kind of cast aside after they retire.
Yeah, and I think, it's not our place really it's not our place to speak about these things. But I felt like, well, we both felt like we had to. But really, if you want to know about black experiences in sport, black experiences of racism in the UK or the USA, listen to black people, read things written by black people. I'm glad you're listening to what we're saying, but we are not the people who should really be listened to, no matter what we say, whether it's right or wrong. We should.
It's
move
a fine
on,
line but, to line to tread, because we aren't the people that should be listened to, but I think we also have, you know, a responsibility as two people that do have a not huge but, you know, somewhat of a platform. I think it's a responsibility on us to make sure that we aren't ignoring these things and talking about them properly and giving the attention that they deserve on here, but also acknowledge that, you know, this isn't going to change if it's only white people involved in kind of charting a new course for what the future of the Premier League and other sports and other and countries will look like.
Yeah, but I think, for example, we're going to talk about the Bundesliga in our next episode, but Jadon Sancho made his own personal protest when he scored in the Bundesliga with a Justice for George Floyd thing. Marcus Thuram did the same, and these are two black players. Now, some white people, obviously white people, have joined the protest in London and in different countries, different cities, everywhere. But it would be great to see, well, as the Premier League returns, as the associations and institutions have said, yes, you are allowed to make a personal protest about George Floyd, about racism in the country, which is again another significant step. for us to see white football players be sending these messages out, because it's great that Jadon Sancho is doing this. It's great that Marcus Thuram is doing this. But where are the white players speaking up? Because that will have an effect. And we are going to move on. But football or the tribalism that has existed within football since the 70s, although hooliganism has historically been around since the early 1900s, that tribalism almost encourages these kind of opinions or actions that we're seeing in London on this Saturday, June the 13th. And for a football fan, it's natural to hate the other and protect at all costs your own community. And I think as people away from football, you've got to think, hold on, I'm not supporting Manchester United now. I'm a person. There is no other person I need to hate. There is no reason for me to defend my community at all costs and not look at how we can better ourselves. We should now move on to talk very quickly about some football before we leave it. But any final things to add before we talk about Odion Ighalo extending his stay at Manchester United?
No, not from me.
Cool, right. Odion Ighalo is staying until January 2021. That makes me happy. An obvious choice for Manchester United, an obvious choice for Odion Ighalo. And to be fair, United have done well to secure that deal, because there was some suggestion that Shanghai were going to say no, but partly because players can't actually get back into China right now, and United can obviously pay a bit of money. It seems sensible all round. I'm looking forward to watching Odion Ighalo again, because it would have been so sad if he'd had this brilliant short spell cut short too prematurely.
Yeah, I think it was a great move by United. I mean, it made sense for all parties. It was one of those deals that really benefited everyone, and it made too much sense for it to not get done. But for United's part, I think a great deal. Ighalo showed so much for us when he was here from in January, February, and the start of March. I mean, honestly, he became a really integral part of our lineup. I think not only just coming off the bench, but even games he started in, he provided us so much of a focal point in attack. And I'm really excited to see him, you know, get this opportunity. And it made sense as a way of extending the loan rather than, you know, making it a permanent deal for now, because we don't know what Ighalo is going to look like after, you know, a few months away. And it sounded like Shanghai Shenhua were asking for quite a lot of money for, you know, what is, despite how good Ighalo has been for us, he is a, you know, an older player who we wouldn't expect to be in United's lineup for more than a year or two.
If we couldn't have gotten on a loan move, then there was no point. Right, United players who we think will do best out of the starting blocks. United return to action on June the 19th against Tottenham Hotspur. Our first game at the new Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, which is a rubbish name. They need to find an actually good name to give it. But we were talking about this before. I think the United players, it's kind of a different thing. Which United players are you most excited to see? And which ones do you think will do best or benefit most from this restart? And for me, the answer to that latter question is Marcus Rashford, Luke Shaw and Paul Pogba. Shaw, I think, because he gets a chance, he'll be the first choice coming into this, I think. Whereas before it was kind of a debate between him and Williams, and because he always benefits from being fresh. Marcus Rashford and Paul Pogba both coming back from injury and both having a chance to, they've obviously benefited from having this chance to properly recover. And to be honest, I'm not that excited for the actual matches that United are going to play because of the fact that I can't go to them, that no fans can go to them, that they are going to be a bit weird and not proper Premier League football. But what I am excited to see, is Marcus Rashford.
Yeah, I think the three that I picked out were Rashford as well, because I am very excited to watch him play, having been out for so long. Dan James, which may be a little bit out of left field, but I just felt he'd been in such a rut of form before COVID brought the season to an end prematurely. But he finally got his goal in our final game against LASK in the Europa League. And I think he feels like very much a confidence player. But I also think, you know, that this is potentially an opportunity for Dan James to be able to come back and, you know, have worked on a few technical aspects of his game, which he may not have had time to work on before COVID sort of forced everyone into lockdown. So he may be able to come back and have a good impact. And then the other one is Odion Ighalo, who, I mean, really, I feel like it could go either way with Ighalo. I think the rest could either be great for him to allow him to recharge a little bit and you know, still have this excitement of now being a Man United player for a little bit longer.
Yeah.
Or it may be that, you know, Ighalo is, as I said, an older player, and sometimes having a few months out can really set back older players and get them out of that rhythm. So we'll see what happens there.
Yeah, and he was in such a good run that it felt like he was kind of scoring and playing so well partly because he just joined United, and he joined late and then scored and then just carried on going and going, and that will obviously have disrupted him a bit. Right, the main thing apart from Black Lives Matter that we wanted to talk about on today, this episode of the podcast, is how does he fit Bruno Fernandes and Paul Pogba into the same midfield, or kind of what is our ideal Manchester United 11? Now there are so many options to United's midfield now, and I think the first thing I'll point out is that the problem is that, as we saw before, once one of Pogba and Bruno Fernandes gets injured, you're looking at the midfield and thinking, I'm not completely convinced by now. But with all of them fit, you've got the options of a three-man midfield of Pogba, Fernandes, Fred, McTominay, Pogba, Fernandes, McTominay, Fred, and one of Bruno and Pogba. And this is the thing. I think the real debate is, both Pogba and Bruno can play deep or further forward. It's about who you want in that deep role, I think, because both are clearly so talented further forward. And who do you rely on more at the moment?
Yeah, it's a tough question. And while I don't really think we'd be able to answer until we've seen a couple of games with them playing together. I mean, first and foremost, before kind of talking about how they might line up, it is so exciting to have a midfield that actually has some exciting options for the first time in... I don't even know how long. I mean, probably the last time I've probably been this excited about United midfield was when Angel Di Maria was first putting on a United shirt in, when was that, 2015? and that didn't end very well, so let's hope this has a better ending. But I mean, with the sort of main four options of Fred, McTominay, Pogba and Bruno Fernandes, we have a genuine selection headache, and in a good way, probably for the first time in a long time, where that selection headache is... you're going to have to leave out some good players rather than we're going to have to play some pretty poor players, which is not a situation United have been in for a very long time.
Very true.
I mean, one thing that I'd be intrigued by, I don't see this happening, especially not the first couple of games back, but one thing I'd be intrigued by would be Solskjaer, whether he would be willing to kind of revert to the diamond midfield that he actually played against Spurs away last January at Wembley, where... I can't actually remember who it was that day. It would have been Pogba, Lingard, maybe who else would it have been there? Maybe McTominay in there and someone else. I can't remember now.
Herrera, maybe.
Yeah, probably would have been Herrera. Yeah, and I mean it worked brilliantly that day against Tottenham. It obviously means that we lose a little bit of width going forward. But you know, could we potentially get the four of them in a midfield together with sort of McTominay at the base, or and then Fred and Pogba as the sort of the two in either side, and then Bruno Fernandes at the tip of the diamond. It's something to consider, but I don't see it happening straight out.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think the interesting thing, and this is what I think Gary Neville was suggesting it, or not suggesting it, but he was saying, you're asking how do you get the best out of both of them, or how do you fit both of them in when City have had David Silva and Kevin De Bruyne for the last 3 years and won two Premier League titles. And I think the problem for United is Matic is kind of a good holding midfielder, but isn't quick enough to recover. And then behind him, you've got Maguire and Lindelof at the moment, who neither of whom are quick enough really to fulfil that role as well. Whereas I think City have had their weaknesses, but they've just been so good in attack that it hasn't mattered. The interesting thing, I think, would be having Pogba and Bruno to the left and right in that three-man midfield, rather than having only one of them forward and having someone sitting. I think that's the most exciting option. It's just who you have at that base of the midfield. And while I like McTominay, I like Fred, and to be fair, I've enjoyed watching Matic actually before the break, I don't think any of them are good enough for that role. None of them are Fernandinho.
No, I think the one that I would have most confidence in would probably be McTominay to be able to cover the ground and be good enough defensively. But my one worry with McTominay is that he's almost too good going forward, actually. He's really, really improved that aspect of his game this season. And he has a tendency to join in attacks a lot, which is great when he's not the only holding midfielder there. My worry with Fred is just simply that, you know, he puts himself about. He's a scrappy player, but I don't know if he has the physical presence to really be a good enough holding midfielder on his own.
A bit like Herrera.
Yeah, exactly. And then Matic has the opposite problem. He has the physical presence. He just can't get himself to the ball quickly enough, to put it in its simplest form. So it is a bit of a dilemma. I also wonder whether Solskjaer might consider going to a sort of three or five at the back option as well, to maybe add a little bit more protection, and then maybe playing a three-man midfield of Pogba, Bruno, and then either one of those other three, Fred, McTominay and Matic. It obviously limits our options in attack a little bit, but you know, if you had a back three of sort of Eric Bailly or Axel Tuanzebe with Lindelof and Maguire, and with Shaw and Aaron Wan-Bissaka as your wing-backs, who have shown, you know, they can do a good job in that role. With that three in midfield and then Martial and Rashford up top, that suddenly looks like quite an exciting lineup. It's just whether we would want to go to a formation that on paper looks quite defensive by having the three centre-backs in games. I mean, against Tottenham, it wouldn't look quite so bad, but, you know, if we're playing sort of lower Premier League clubs, the optics of that don't look the best.
Yeah, I think so. But three at the back does give you some possibilities in attack that you wouldn't otherwise had. And I think the problem is that our fullbacks, who would become our wingbacks, don't really suit that. I think Shaw and Williams to a certain extent, but Wan-Bissaka is clearly more suited to being a defensive right back. Because the timing of his tackle is so good, and well, he's just a brilliant defender, and he's an average attacker. So it's a couple of strange ones to weigh up, and it'll be really interesting to see how Solskjaer puts United out in that first game against Spurs, and it's something I'm really looking forward to. We're gonna leave it here in just a second, but the next episode, which we have released at the same time as this one, we're gonna be talking about and previewing the Tottenham game in a bit more detail, and talking about how the Premier League's returned, how what we thought of the Bundesliga, the Bundesliga's comeback, etc. So we're going to leave it here in a second, but any more thoughts on Pogba and Bruno?
I think that's pretty much it for me. I'm excited to finally see them play together. I feel like I've waited for this moment for years, it feels like. And actually, I guess the one good thing about this situation for United is that it has allowed Pogba and Rashford to get back fit, and at least they will be able to contribute in this running, however long the run-in ends up taking.
Yeah, I think the most is also that Rashford's coming back, and we've never actually seen Rashford play with Bruno Fernandes, and I think that's another really exciting.
Yeah.
And I think the great thing is that even if both of them aren't performing every game, what you've now got is two midfielders that the opposition will be scared of, and that means that in previous seasons, sometimes we've seen three players on Pogba, and a lot of the time this season we've seen three players marking Rashford, whereas now you've got the kind of triple attack of Bruno, Pogba and Rashford. Martial, if he can find some form again, and he was doing well before the break. And it's just a bit more variety and a bit, you're stretching teams more. And I think that's something to look forward to. And it could open up space for other players like Dan James as well. Just before we go, I'm going to give you just a quick update on the women's team. The WSL, the Women's Super League season was ended. Chelsea were awarded the title, and they and Manchester City have qualified for the Champions League. Manchester United, Casey Stoney's United side, with the season ended early due to the coronavirus, they finished fourth in our first ever season in the Women's Super League. So it started with an historic opening day win against Liverpool and ends in strange circumstances, but it's been a good campaign to finish fourth in only our second season with a women's team is pretty impressive. And everyone has really done a fantastic job with the creation of that women's side and the way it's gelled. And there's a long way to go, about 13, 15 more points to be precise, but to catch up with the leading women's side in the country, but it's certainly a positive. Right, please go and listen to our next episode, which will either be out right now or depends when you're listening to this, where we're going to talk about the Spurs game in some more detail and a few other more football-related things. But I hope you've enjoyed all of our conversation, which has been a mixture of politics and sport, which they do mix. Don't never try and pretend that they don't. For more from us, you can find Jack on Twitter at
UTDTait, T-A-I-T.
And you can find me on Twitter at HarryRobinson64, and the podcast itself at UTDWeeklyPod. That's P-O-D at the end there. If you want to support us, you can leave us a review on iTunes or just share it with one of your mates. That's always helpful. Right, have a great week.
Sports Podcast Network.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.